Alexia Gordon, author of the Gethsemane Brown Mysteries, published by Henry Press, and the host of the Cozy Corner podcast, part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Katrina McPherson joins me in the Cozy Corner today. Katrina is the author of two series, the Dandy Gilver Mysteries and the Lexi Campbell Mysteries, as well as several standalone suspense novels. The most recent standalone, Strangers at the Gate, is available from October 22nd in the U.S. Dandy Gilver number 13, A Step So Grave, is available from November 5th. Welcome, Katrina.
Thank you for having me. It's lovely to talk to you.
It's always a pleasure. You write two series, one historical and one humorous contemporary, plus almost a dozen standalone novels. How do you manage all that?
Is it really a dozen? Oh, yeah, there is, because there's two early ones that don't sort of count. But yeah, you're right, yeah, it's almost a dozen. How do I cope with all that? Do you know, to be really honest, Alexia, what it was that when I had a proper job, I was so bad at it and I was so unhappy at it that I left, even though I left at the end of 2000, which is a long time ago now, I can still remember what it felt like to be doing the wrong thing. And on any given day, that helps me just spit on my hands and do what needs to be done to be a writer, because I still love it in comparison.
But I find it hard to believe you were ever bad at anything.
Oh God, yeah, it was shocking. I didn't get it. Can you imagine someone doing a fairly high status job that they're manifestly not suited for? Let's not go there. Let's just stay in Cozy Corner. But no, I wasn't. I didn't get it. I was a linguistics professor and I understood linguistics and I understood teaching and I loved the students. I could not wrap my head around working in a university department. I didn't get it. I couldn't decipher the politics and I didn't know what it was that people, I didn't understand the stakes that people had. I didn't understand the factors in every meeting. I could feel the atmosphere, but I didn't know what was going on. Oh, I really, really hated it.
Well, we're all glad you turned to crime writing then.
No, me too. Thank you. That's very kind.
Now, I refer to your standalones as suspense novels. Is that how you describe them?
Oh, do you know, I describe them as standalone suspense domestic noir psychological thrillers, because I just use all the words, then you know that the words you need are going to be in there. Or do you know, I've got a new description for them based on the jackets. If you imagine the archetypal jacket of a domestic noir standalone suspense psychological thriller standalone novel, okay, I call them now, where's she off to now, books? Because there's always a woman on the cover and she's always walking away. So that's what I'm trying to get that started. Where's she off to now? She used to wear a red coat. She's not wearing a red coat anymore, but she's still going somewhere. Where's she off to? So that's what I call them. But maybe once the publisher hears that, I might get a stiff email telling me not to say that anymore. Ah, it's just good fun.
I think you should hashtag that, actually.
What a good idea. Yes, I think I will. The next time I put my book jacket online, which will be tomorrow, let's face it, because I'm in the middle of shameless promo for this book, I'm going to do that. Yeah.
Speaking of your suspenseful, domestic, psychological thriller, Strangers at the Gate, to me it has kind of a Gothic meets Hitchcock meets Masterpiece Mystery feel. So what were your influences while you were writing it?
I love it. My influences while I was writing it mostly came from landscape, to be honest. So they were outside of fiction. I can't think in terms of a... Let me just check whether that's true. Yes, I think it is. I didn't think in terms of where the book fitted into the genre or into the tradition of suspense. I will take Hitchcock and Masterpiece Theatre every day, though. It came from thinking about Scotland, my old country, and making up a fictitious valley that's so narrow and deep that it gets no sunlight at all in the winter months, and there are places like that in Scotland, and just what it would feel like to move there from a city. I mean, not Vegas, you know, Edinburgh, but still streetlights. What it would feel like to move to a small town with no sunshine and terrible mobile phone reception in the middle of winter. So I thought myself into that dark place, which doesn't really answer your question. Sorry.
Although it does. The place influenced it, and just from that description, I promised I would be terrified to live in a place like that.
Yeah, well, I remember, I lived in a city when I was a student, but I come from a small town, but I'd never lived in the real deep, dark countryside until we moved to the countryside in 1996, and it was dark, you could see the Milky Way, the sky was absolutely black. And some of Finney's experiences in the book are my early experiences, like not recognizing the screech of a vixen, which is very human and traumatizing to hear if you've never heard it before, a vixen screaming at night, and also an owl, which I thought was some kind of unearthly supernatural creature that was coming straight for me, because I thought, oh, what's that noise? And turned my torch, what you'd call a flashlight beam, up and annoyed this owl, so it decided to dive bomb me down through the light, and it just came straight for me, and they're quite big when they're close. So I gave that experience to Finney, of suddenly being in a very isolated cottage in the pitch black, surrounded by trees, which you know, when you look into trees at night, you see the trees behind the trees, but they look as if they're moving because of perspective and geometry. And so it really does look as if there are people flitting around in the dark. Yeah. I loved it. She hates it. But I loved living in the countryside with them.
I'm not really a fan of the countryside. I'm just thinking of the talons. Owls kill small animals, so I wouldn't really want one coming at my head.
No, I didn't enjoy it either. I learned never to shine a torch beam up underneath an owl again. I only did that once. But the first time the very first night that, or maybe the first night or second night when we moved to that house, we went outside to drive to civilization and get, you know, some kind of disgusting pizza that was available 25 miles away. And because, you know, I'm saying isolated for a tiny wee country like Scotland, not isolated like Montana. You can't get very far away from anything in Scotland. But it was so dark outside, we couldn't find the car. And so we thought, we'll go back and get a torch. And we turned around and it was so dark, we couldn't see the house. So we were just stumbling around in the blackness. We got used to it. We didn't get organised. We never kept torches anywhere, but we got used to stumbling around, not being able to see anything. So it was okay. We never fell over. We did used to have tadpoles coming out the faucets sometimes, because the water just came down off the hill. It was delicious, but it just ran down the hill through the house and out again. And every so often there'd be a fat tadpole that would get stuck in the tap.
Is there like a tadpole rusted filter?
No, it had a UV filter, but they didn't seem to mind that. Maybe it wasn't working properly, but we survived and we don't live there anymore. We just had that big power out, you know, in California here.
Yeah.
PG&E said, prepare for a week. And I thought, oh God, I can't even stand that. But it was only 20 hours in the end. But our water went off because we've got a well, because we still live out in the country, in California. Oh. And so it all got a bit real there. I think I'm getting soft now. I'm a bit of a convenience junkie from living in your lovely country where everything's always open and everything's available. This 20-hour power cut was not fun.
No, it's not. When you get used to streetlights, you're used to streetlights.
Oh, yeah, we haven't got any streetlights. It won't go that bad. But we've usually got water, which is nice.
Now, in a place that's not quite so dark, and the setting for us, A Step So Grave, which is your 13th Fanny Gilmore mystery. It's set in the 1930s. And it's full of aristocrats and country manners and witty dialogue, which is reminiscent of Agatha Christie or one of the other crime writers from the golden age of detective fiction in the 20s and 30s. So was this intentional? Were you inspired by the detective fiction of that era?
Oh, in this case, absolutely. The first Dandy Gilbert that I wrote it in 2002, I think. And it was when, I mean, I don't know, I've never asked you this, if you've got a first novel that you had to, that you loved and thought was perfect, and then you had to give up and put it in a drawer. But when I put my first novel in a drawer and gave up after 40 rejections, I thought, oh, I just need a little confidence booster. Now, what do I love? What do I wish there were more of? What am I, and no one's ever going to see it. I'll just write it for me. It'll be a secret. And I absolutely loved the Golden Age detective stories of the 20s and 30s. So Niall Marsh and Marjorie Allingham, Agatha Christie and Dorothy Seattle Sayers, of course, and also Michael Innes, who's a favourite of mine. So I absolutely sat down to see if I could do what they, you know, even though I'm now, if I could put myself back into the past and try and write one of those books. And now I've written 13 because my little secret palette cleanser went quite well, which is lovely.
So what's the challenge of channeling the Golden Age while keeping the story relatable to contemporary readers?
Oh, yeah, it's tough. It's tough. What else have I tried? Psychiatric nursing, no thanks. It's not tough. It's easy. However, one of the toughest bits of this very easy job is that, well, there's two differences. The one that they were writing just after the end of the First World War, and they didn't talk about it. Their books were an escape from the horror of that and the influenza pandemic, and you know, then there was the depression, the Great Recession, and so they knew all that and they didn't put it in their books. But I can't miss it out. I'm writing about these people and I find that I can't not take account of the fact that there are a lot of spinster ladies, because their sweethearts died, or the men who would have become their sweethearts had died. And a lot of shell-shocked men. And I was born in 1965, and I'm just old enough to, so that when I was a wee girl, those women who never married were still alive, and they were still running everything. They were tremendous. You know, they organised the church and the brownies and the guides and the schools and everything in the village that I come from. So I loved them. And I remember the day that it occurred to me why there were so many of these women, because in 1970 by then they were still there. So that's one thing that I do take account of, the war, and you better believe I take account of what's coming in 1939, because I can't, they didn't know, they feared that it was coming, but I know it's coming, and it's like a drumbeat. And I think the other thing that I can't do is, I don't know if you've read, especially Dorothy L. Sayers, who I do adore, but the casual racism and anti-Semitism in her books is quite hard to stomach now. So I do this thing where, because I am a woman and I get to find the line, I let there be the kind of sexism that there would have been, you know, I let that be authentic. And because I'm Scottish, Dandy Gilbert is English, but she's married to a Scot. Because I'm Scottish, you know, you get to laugh at your own people. So I have a bit of fun with that. And I'm also a working class person. So I let her be as big a snob as she would have been, because she's an aristocrat. So I let her do that. But I don't have any truck with the eminently possible anti-Semitism, racism and homophobia that might have been there in her, and certainly in some of her contemporaries, because that's not my line to find. And also, do you know, I think, well, here I am, a working class Scottish girl who got a PhD and I'm now a writer and I live in California. It's like the things that were my challenges are not as severe as they were. But I don't think that's true for, you know, racism and anti-Semitism and homophobia. So I just stay away from them. I mean, I don't make everyone a paragon of virtue. I just stay away from it. So that's a difference for me. I couldn't do it. Because I think, I'm serious about my writing. And even though some of my books aren't serious, I'm serious about them. But I still think people matter more than stories, when you get right down to it. Here endeth the lesson. There you go. That's what you... Well, you asked. What are you going to do? You asked.
I did ask, but it was an excellent answer. That's why I didn't interrupt. That was an excellent answer. You did remind, when you were talking about the spinsters, there's a podcast called the She Done It Show, where one of the episodes is devoted to the surplus women, who are the women who never married after the war, because most of the marriageable men were dead.
Were dead. Yeah, that's what they were called, wasn't it? Surplus women. That's awful. Yeah, they were the women that I knew as a child. They were tremendous, and they seemed happy. They seemed happy in a way that mothers and grandmothers didn't seem happy. Now go figure, right? Let's ponder that. There was a sort of playfulness and a willingness to be delighted by things about them, even though their lives must have been hard. But yeah, certainly they didn't seem like sad women to me, not a one.
Now, when you write, do you focus on one series or standalone at a time, sort of writing a given book from start to finish before moving on to the next? Or do you jump from Dandy to Lexi to standalone and write multiple books simultaneously?
Well, sort of a bit of both. I write a first draft of one book with nothing else, except if page proofs come in. So you've just got to check things over that the publisher might have sent back. I'll just stop. But I can't write, I can't be working on a first draft of, say, a modern standalone. It's A Stranger at the Gate in the morning and then do a couple of hours of page proofs of Dandy Gilver checking the semicolons in the afternoon. Very monolithic about it. But once that first draft's done, I find it really helpful to print it out and then just leave it sitting on my desk and do something else entirely from start to finish. So I've got a monster edit sitting on my desk at the moment, actually, which is the biggest edit I've ever... I've said it too late. I decided to do something structurally quite ambitious for me. Not actually structurally ambitious, just for me, you know. And it worked, and my editor's happy with it. But while I was concentrating on weaving these voices together, some of the other things I would normally be doing fell by the wayside. So I've got a big edit to do. And I know that that's going to be something I have to just focus on completely and immerse myself in. Is that how you do it? Do you do one thing till it's done and then do something else?
Well, right now I've only written books in one series, but I do have a standalone that I'm playing through. So I, in between rounds of edits, I did an outline. I took advantage of one of my long flights for a business trip to do an outline for the new one that I'm working on. And now my next round of edits for my series is due next week. So when I turn that in, I'll have a little while where I can try and flesh out my outline a little more and maybe get some pages written.
I don't outline, and I think maybe if I outlined, I'd be able to be less, hysterical about it. I think that's probably the word. But what you said, I love working on long plane journeys. It's great because you're so cocooned and nobody can get you. Nobody can ask you for anything. You just have to pass your trash to the aisle and that's it.
Yes.
You know, so I do. It's a great place to do the initial thinking, especially in the window seat, just look out at the clouds. I agree with you about that. I'm very interested to think that, you're doing a standalone. I'm not going to meddle. I don't know if you like me. I'm so furtive about what I'm writing, but until it's finished, I don't talk about it at all. So I don't answer any questions about it until that first draft's out. And then I'll talk about it. Then it's kind of bulletproof. But I wouldn't, I just want to say, I quite often want to say to beginning writers, don't tell anyone, don't talk about it, just keep it a secret between you and the characters until they're all born and it's all done, because you can't embarrass yourself, it doesn't really matter, no one's going to see it.
That's true.
But it's not my business.
I try and talk about it just enough so that somebody can hold me accountable for doing it, but not so much that
oh yeah Yeah, that's a good idea. So you put it out there that you're doing it and what your deadline is. I've done that. Said I'm going to finish this. I'm going to start a book and I'm going to finish it by this date. Hey, do you know what's really funny? When someone says, you know how people say when you're a writer, are you writing anything? And you say, yes, always, because you're a writer and that's the only way it works. But I had a couple of times I happened to be, I can't remember where I was, but out in public. And I said, oh yeah, I started a book yesterday, and got this really kind of cross-eyed, astounded looking face. So, what do you mean? I said, I started, it's Tuesday night, so I started yesterday morning. I started a new one. And it was, have you ever had that? Kind of people being quite, I think, well, how else could it happen? You've got, on one day you have to start and on one day you have to finish. Why is it more surprising that I started a new book yesterday morning than that I started a book 12 weeks ago? I never understood, but it was two different people on that same day that said, or maybe they were just thinking, really, after that last one you're doing another one? Okay. But I'm pretty sure I know what it was, so that if that ever happens again, I am going to press them on it and say, what is it that you're reacting to? That's weird.
Hey, they think the book's just sort of spring forth completely finished.
There was one, I won't give any identifying features to when this interaction was, in case the person hears the interview, but there was someone who just said straight out to me a few years ago something that it was lucky that I could drop everything and go somewhere because I don't work. And I sort of knew what they meant. I mean, I don't have, you know, I don't clock on. But then when I said, when the Tour de France was going through this little village in Galloway where we lived when we lived in Scotland, and someone said, oh, do you want to come and watch the Tour de France and go for a cup of coffee? And I said, I can't, I'm working. And she said, oh, great, you've got a job. And I said, yeah, I've got a job, I'm a writer. And she said, oh, well, you can come out then. And I said, no, I can't, because I'm working. And it was this absolute inability to understand that you don't get a relief writer, you know, if you go off and do something else instead. You've got to actually just sit and do it. And I know you must get that, right?
Okay. Yeah, I've had a few people tell me that, oh, I could write a book if I had time. Like,
oh, that's the only thing that's missing. You know, oh, it's the only thing that's ever missing, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, you know, I've got the same 24 hours you've got, and I'm also here at the day job, so just saying.
Yeah, absolutely.
Those people usually end up as victims in my novels, but that's another story.
I've never done that. I've actually never done that. I've got a close friend, again, I can't identify her, who did it really specifically to a real estate development lawyer. She lives in a big city, and she made him into a severed head. She made his severed head absolutely recognisable to anyone who'd ever met the guy.
That's brilliant. So severed heads aside, how is writing a more suspenseful novel like Strangers at the Gate so different than writing a more traditional mystery like A Steps of Grey? Different process?
I think they're more similar than they look from the jackets. You know, they look miles apart. But I think, I don't think I have to tie everything up quite so neatly in a modern, realistic, I mean, these are real people. There's Dandy Gilver, I mean, she's real to me. But she's not real. She wouldn't have the money that she's got. She's, you know, it's not at all clear why they're not in desperate financial straits, as they probably would be if they were aristocrats in the mid-30s. And there's that there's that one thing that we accept, we Golden Age fans, that there is going to be a private detective who solves a murder. I don't know if that's ever happened. You know, there's going to be either an amateur sleuth or a private detective that solves a murder. So that's the thing that I let happen. But I have to let the police in to the modern ones, to the more realistic ones at some point. But that, I love that, because that means when it gets to the boring bit about witness statements and evidence and things, I just hand it all over to the cops and epilogue and I'm out. So I'm interested in the in what's going on in people's minds in these books, not in how they catch or what they do to the person after they've caught them. So yeah, it feels I quite enjoy that. I don't think I could write a police procedure. In fact, I know I couldn't write a police procedural or a legal thriller or a forensic thriller or anything where you have to actually know anything. Not for me.
You obviously do some research though. So how does your approach to research differ between your contemporary novels and your Danny Gilbert series?
Well, I do some research. I do a lot of making it up, because if you make it up with enough gusto, everybody just goes with it and no one ever questions you about any of it. So I do make things up. But I'm quite honest about what I've made up. I usually put a little note in saying what I've made up. The research for Dandy Gilver is almost all about the setting initially. So I go to the place and just sit there. I don't do anything that looks like research. I just look as if I'm on a short break in a nice bed and breakfast, and I'm walking about hills, or you know, I went to the circus a lot for one of them, and that didn't look at all like research, just going to the circus. But it just seeps in. Whereas the research for the for Strangers at the Gate is much more specific, and it comes after I've written it. So I write it and I make it all up. And then sometimes even I admit that I've got to check whether any of the stuff I've made up is possible. And so I do quite efficient, just not exactly Googling, because I don't like what you get from Google, but going into a local library in a town in Scotland and trawling through their press clippings and speaking to the archivists and asking some questions about, I'm going to look at things. What did I have to research for Strangers? Well, I had to research what a deacon would do, a full-time, I mean, I know that you are a deacon, but a full-time professional deacon. So sort of like a social worker with a peculiar uniform, I suppose, in the modern Church of Scotland. So I did some research into that, but that was after I'd written the book and after I'd written everything that Finney did as a deacon. First in her city parish and then in her week, so that the whole book's set over the course of there's before, that's a prologue, and then there's a week, seven full days, and then there's a little short epilogue. So there's not a great deal of her professional life, but I had to know something to make it realistic. And her husband's a solicitor, a lawyer, so I had to find out some stuff about that. I think that was all, actually. I don't think there was anything else. Oh, there was, but I can't talk about it because of spoilers.
Okay. Now, when I read that Finn was a deacon, I of course immediately thought Episcopalian, which would translate to Anglican, which would translate to Church of England, which is absolutely not the Church of Scotland.
No.
Which is Presbyterian. No. So what led you to choose a Presbyterian deacon as the protagonist?
Oh, do you know what? I've no idea. I knew that for the purposes of the plot, I thought her husband had to be a lawyer. And I've just recently found the early notes that I was making when I was doing this. You know, when I was in Scotland and I was down in the borders in the pine forests, thinking, what's this book about then? Who are these people? And I thought that she had all kinds of jobs in my head. So I don't know, I hope I can remember some of them now. So she was going to be something like, she was going to be a website designer. And I thought that maybe she could work as a theatre manager. So, I mean, completely wildly different from what she ended up as. And I honestly can't remember why I eventually thought she's going to snag this full-time position as a you know, there's a couple of years of hard money, and then her job has got to become self-supporting, and a lot of her time is spent on secondment from the church, working for an adoption charity that deals with difficult to place children. And I cannot remember where that came from, and now it seems unthinkable that she would ever have been anything else. I'll let you know if it comes back to me, why she's a, well, oh no, I've remembered. Here you go. Just keep talking, wait for the brain to catch up. I do remember now, because I decided that I wanted her to be someone who was good, like you deacons are. I wanted her to be, because I thought, and I can't remember why I thought this, but I thought, I've never really written about goodness, about someone who's, you know, a force for good. And I thought, well, what's she going to be? She could be a social worker. Oh God, that's going to be a lot of research. She could be, I thought she could maybe just be someone who, I was thinking of Deborah Lacey, who works for the Gates Foundation, you know, who, and I thought, no, that's going to be, that's too, I want her to have more face-to-face interaction with people than that. And I was walking around the town that Simmerton in the book is based on, and there was the local parish church of Scotland and their fundraising appeal for something that I can't remember now. And I thought, oh, wouldn't that be interesting if she moved to this small town into a ready-made community, and she is just a good person. She's not a snarky biatch like most, well, she, and then she is in the end, but you know, she didn't start that way like many of my heroines. Yeah, and it was hard. It's much easier to write about bad people.
That's a good line.
Well, I think so.
Speaking of the small town Simmerton, when I was reading Strangers at the Gate, Edgar Allan Poe was another author who came to mind with the descriptions of darkness and the claustrophobia and the strange things attacking you in the dark. So given that it'll be, actually this episode will air the day before Halloween, so can you recommend some spooky stories for our listeners?
Ooh, stories rather than movies. Let's have a go. Well, I am a massive Stephen King fan. I'm a huge Stephen King fan. I'm trying so hard not to read his new one. I'm trying to save it for the Christmas holidays. But I can see it. It's in the room that I'm in right now and I might not make it. So I would think you couldn't go wrong with Pet Sematary if you really like a jump scare. But it traumatised me when I was a child. I mean, I read it too young. And I think that Daphne du Maurier, if you, maybe even The Birds, the short story, you could read the short story and then watch the film and then try and have a scholarly discussion about it, calm down before bed. That would be a good one. What else has terrified me recently? Oh, here we go. Alex Marwood, the Killer Next Door. It's not supernatural. It's just, it's just really frightening. But specifically with ghosts in her. Can I have a film instead of a book?
Sure.
How about The Others?
Oh, I find that.
Yeah, I find that unsettling. Or here's the, how disgraceful is this? How about Quiet Neighbours? That's another one of mine. But it's about someone who lives in a cottage in a graveyard in a small town in Scotland, of course. And it's got some shivers in it.
Excellent.
I'm too chicken to read. I'm too cowardly to read much out and out horror. I read Stephen King because I love him, but I do scare myself dreadfully when I read them.
So did you scare yourself writing the atmospheric scenes in Strangers at the Gate?
Absolutely, yes. I completely did. I freaked myself out badly a couple of times when I was, because I still live, like I say, I still live out some quite an isolated house, and my husband travels a lot, so I'm often here alone, and it's, you know, it's dark and it's a dirt road, and there are a lot of noises. It's usually gophers, but you know, there are some noises. Yeah, I did frighten myself writing the scenes when she goes to the, if you've read it, when she goes to the other house, the house that's shut, that we hear about right from the start, this house called Jerusalem. So everybody talks about it, and I think, well, you've made a contract with the reader, haven't you? If you talk about this burned out shell of a house, then at some point you've got to go there. And it was based on a real place, which hadn't been burned out, it was just derelict near where I used to live. And I really did freak myself out writing those scenes to a ridiculous extent, because I was fine. I was sitting in a nice, comfortable study with a phone. But yeah, I did frighten myself. I tell you when I frightened myself, trying to find a... wait a minute, is this a different book? Oh, this is a different book. I was trying to find a title for the next Dandy Gilver, and I ended up reading Deuteronomy. Now, I don't know when you last read Deuteronomy from start to finish, but it is quite insistently, what would I say, negative would be a kind way to put it. It is very unsettling because there's a lot of it, and there's a kind of drumbeat of repetition of the things that the writer of Deuteronomy or the scribe of Deuteronomy was interested in. That's the last time I scared myself. The Bible. Yeah.
Unsettling is a good word. I could think of some others, like bloody and frightening and terrifying. That's Deuteronomy is the favorite of people who go around quoting things like witches should be burned and things. So.
Yeah. I mean, I knew about Leviticus. He's famous for it. But I honestly did not know that Deuteronomy was quite so far down the same road. I had to stop in the end, and I didn't get a title. I couldn't find a title in the whole of Deuteronomy. So yeah. I'm still looking for a title for that book. Titles are hard. Titles are hard, and you've made a rod for your own back because you've got... when are you going to run out? I shouldn't sound as gleeful as that. I hope you never run out. But I have got a sense of relief every time you talk about a new book. I think, she's got another one. Good. Phew. Good. I would be kind of scared. I would be worried.
I can start adding flats and sharps to the notes, and it expands the range a bit.
I find that, and I didn't think up the title "Strangers at the Gate." That was from the U.S. editor at Minotaur. And she's not my editor anymore. My editor left the company, and you know, I got a new editor, and she was already planning to leave when she got me, so she wasn't around for long. I got on really well with her, and I miss her. But the one thing she did do in the short few months that she was my editor was come up with this brilliant title when everybody else was stumped. I was completely stumped. Well, no, I had a title that I loved, but no one else liked it, so I let it go.
Now, speaking of titles, where can people buy your titles?
Oh, well, anywhere they should be. They're available for pre-order now, and, you know, Amazon and Barnes & Noble and IndieBound and your favourite local bricks and mortar bookshop. Mine is The Avid Reader in Davis, California. It's already out in the UK. It came out in September, and I've already had I was over there and I had a launch party there. So it's available in, you know, Waterstones and Amazon UK and your favourite local bricks and mortar bookshop in Britain, which for me is in Scotland. The bigger book, I forgot the name. Atkinson Price and Bigger, and in London, Goldsborough Books in Charing Cross Road. So just, you know, wherever, thankfully. Yeah.
And I noticed on your website there's the cover for Dandy Gilver number 14, The Turning Tide. When's that one going to be available?
Yeah, that one, well, with luck, that one's going to be next year because Quercus, have picked up the series in the US again. Dandy's had a very sedate, measured, kind of dull publishing life in London, but it's been all kinds of thrills and spills over here, so I'm very pleased that Quercus have picked up the series again. And I would assume that The Turning Tide will be out a year after this first one. The book that I was hoping to find a title for in Deuteronomy is the one after that. It's finished, except for those all-important words that go on the jacket. We haven't got them yet.
And speaking of next year, you're going to be the, actually, I guess it's year after next, 2021, you'll be the guest of honor at Left Coast Crime in Albuquerque?
Yeah, I know. I'm going to be the Toastmaster at VoucherCon in Sacramento next year, which is lovely. It's just up the road. And I'm going to be the American guest of honor, don't laugh, at Left Coast Crime in Albuquerque. So I'm looking forward to that. And I've already started buying clothes.
Oh.
Yeah, I've got a dress with cactuses on it, cacti on it. And I'm not alone because Chris Zagorski, who's the fan guest of honor, I guess he's a mutual friend. You know Chris, don't you?
Yes.
Yeah, from Bolo Books. He has started laying in cactus-adorned garments already, so I'm going to have to concentrate quite hard. And Kelly Garrett as well is Now, what is she? I think she's the Toastmaster. So it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it.
Sounds great. And where else can readers find you?
Well, I'm at the Avid Reader on the 25th Friday, which is in Davis, California. I'm in Sacramento on the 5th of November. I am going up into the mountains, into the Gold Hills, to a little library called Arnold Library on the 12th of November, which is just heaven up there. And then I am going to shut my door and work. I'm going to get two first drafts out before Left Coast Crime in San Diego next year. I have no... Oh, wait a minute. No, I'm going to be the guest of honour at Sleuth Fest next March. But from mid-November until the end of March in Florida, nothing. I'm door shut, bum on seat, fingers on keyboard, and do the other bit. I am looking forward to Florida. That'd be perfect.
Yeah, I think that'd be great.
Yeah. But you were at Left Coast Crime when it was in Hawaii, weren't you?
Yes.
I was just in the sea the whole time. I was kind of pruny when I was on panels because I only got out of the water if I had to go and sit on a panel. And I'm planning to have dry hair and a kind of salt crust on me when I'm the guest of honour at Sleuth Fest because the water's just heaven down there.
And while you're in your writing cave in between November and March, where can readers get their Katrina fix online?
Oh, well, yes, I will be. I'll be blogging at least one Tuesday a month with Femme Fatale. And I blog two Thursdays a month with, as one of 10 in Seven Criminal Minds. We're not maths geniuses. And I'm on Facebook at Katrina McPherson, and I'm on Twitter at Katrina McP because my name's too long. And I've got my website, katrinamcpherson.com. I bob in there every so often and put pictures on of where I've been. If I do, so I'll get caught. If I do come out and kick up my heels, I'll be caught. So I am around, and it's all very straightforward, just my name will find me. There's a Katrina MacPherson who's a Welsh academic. I think she's a geologist or an archaeologist, and she sometimes gets some of my stuff and always thinks that whatever's in the works for me sounds like more fun than whatever's in the works for her. Poor thing.
And can readers sign up for your newsletter on your website?
Oh, thank you, Alexia. Yes, I'm such a publicist's dream. Yes, I can. Yes, you can. I think on my Facebook page and on my website, there's a sign up for my very occasional newsletter. But I will put the first revelations. I can't say reveals because it's a verb, not a noun. I'm not usually grammar maven. I can't use the word reveal as a noun. The revelation of a title and book jacket and things usually go into my newsletter first in gratitude to the people who signed up for it. So yes.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining me today in the Cozy Corner, Katrina.
Thank you, Alexia. It's lovely to talk to you.
So my guest today was Katrina McPherson, author of the Dandy Gilver Mysteries, the Lexi Carmichael Mysteries, and Strangers at the Gate, an eerily suspenseful standalone. This has been Alexia Gordon, author of the Gethsemane Brown Mysteries. Thank you, listeners, for joining us in the Cozy Corner, part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Until next time, goodbye.